Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
God save Osama bin Laden. You will never get him. Admitted 9/11 co-conspirator Zakarias Moussaoui uttered those words in his final public statement today as he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of release in federal court in Alexandria, Virginia. Moussaoui flashed a victory sign after walking into the courtroom. "You have branded me as a terrorist or a criminal or whatever," he said. "Look at yourselves. I fight for my belief." As she sentenced Moussaoui, U.S. District Judge Leonie Brinkema said, "You will die with a whimper, never allowed to speak publicly again." Greg Gordon is Washington correspondent for the Star Tribune newspaper in Minneapolis. He joins us on the line. Greg, this all came, of course, after the jury rejected the death sentence for Moussaoui yesterday. You were there in the courtroom. It must have been quite something.
Electrifying, Robin. It was an electrifying hearing this morning. After a very dramatic session yesterday when the jury came in with a life sentence when many people thought they would vote to execute Moussaoui.
And now we have this result. There were family members there. What was the reaction?
Family members were allowed and invited by the judge to step to the podium and speak. And there was a hesitation, and then Rosemary Dillard, who lost her husband at the Pentagon, got up and went to the podium and turned face on to talk to Moussaoui. He said, "You wrecked my life, wrecked my career, took the most important person in my life from me." A very angry voice. And she said, "We watch you twiddle at your beard and make faces and feel no remorse. I hope you sit in that jail without seeing the sky, without seeing the sun, without any contact with the world. I feel nothing but disgust." And the two other family members got up and spoke in different tones. One, Abraham Scott, said that he told Moussaoui that basically we're going to catch bin Laden, and I look forward to it, and I hope and pray that he'll be put to death.
Moussaoui tried to overspeak the judge at several times, and she just would have none of it, it seems. Do you have that full quote from the judge when she said, "You'll die with a whimper"?
Yes. Well, here's how it began. She said, she talked about how everybody in the courtroom will be able to go outside, enjoy the sun, hear the birds, eat what they want, go where they want. In terms of winners and losers, it's quite clear who won and lost yesterday. And Moussaoui then interjected, "It was my choice." The judge cut him off and said, "It was hardly your choice. You came here to be a martyr and die in a big bang of glory. But to quote the poet T.S. Eliot, instead you will die with a whimper. You will spend the rest of your life in prison and you'll never again get the chance to speak publicly. And that is an appropriate and fair ending."
Well, as you know, the verdict is being described by some as a setback for the Justice Department, although Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said justice has been served, and the judge seemed to think the same way, that, you know, you're not going to be a martyr, you're going to be silent. Your thoughts watching this trial, and any thoughts that this was a setback?
It was an extraordinary trial, and I've covered a number of them, even going back to the Hinckley trial 25 years ago. But I think that the Justice Department can take this from the trial. They did finally get a forum to tell the story of September 11th. They did it for the victims and with the help of the victims, and it was wrenching, and probably most of the people in the courtroom have had nightmares over the last several weeks about some of the things they heard and saw, but the story came out.
And legal experts have told you that if he had gotten the death sentence, he might have won an appeal, whereas now the judge seemed to indicate you can appeal, but I doubt you'll win it.
That's right. This case was really a legal stretch in that the government, the country, doesn't currently, as a general rule, execute people who were not convicted of murder. Here was somebody who was where the government was trying to win a death sentence when he was convicted essentially of lying. And so a lot of the legal experts felt that the Supreme Court, even a very conservative Supreme Court, and even with all the public pressure, would not let this ruling stand if it were a death sentence.
And very briefly, Greg, we know that France has been asked, officials there are asking for perhaps possibly extraditing Moussaoui to that country to serve a sentence. Any chance of that?
We've just heard this. Sounds like It'll be in this political climate, it'll be tough to do that.
Yeah. But that's still
save some money.
And that still lies ahead. Greg Gordon, Washington correspondent for the Star Tribune newspaper. You've been our eyes and ears during the sentencing trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. Thanks so much. Moussaoui sentenced today to spend the rest of his life in prison. Greg, thank you.
My great pleasure.
Lawmakers in the House of Representatives are saying, take that, big oil, now that they've passed a measure to fine energy companies up to $150 million if they're caught price gouging. But does Congress really have anything to do with high gas prices? Any effect? Coming up, we'll have an update on what else Congress is considering in the way of energy legislation, including a controversial 24-square-mile wind farm that's planned to be located off Cape Cod here in Massachusetts. But first, oil prices fell today for a second day in a row, despite that gas prices still high, consumers still filling up. So what will it take them, okay, maybe us, to slow down? Joining us here in the studio is Professor Henry Lee. He's director of the Environment and Natural Resources Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And Professor, give us some perspective first, because you've compared what we're currently paying for gas and what people are paying for another favorite fuel, coffee. Tell us.
Sure. A cup of coffee at Starbucks will cost you about, if it's regular, $1.75. If it's one of those fancy coffees, it will cost you probably $2.70. That same cup, if it was filled with oil, would cost you 15 cents.
Right. So coffee is in that way more expensive. And I've heard gas station attendants say this. You know, they see people throwing back their Starbucks coffee while complaining about the price of gas. Of course, someone might say, I don't need my coffee. I can do without it. I have to have my gas.
Well, what we teach our students always is that when prices go up, the demand for a commodity will go down. Well, prices for gasoline, while they have vacillated, have been up quite high for about 3 years. And demand has continued to rise, which is contrary to sort of all the laws of economics that we try to teach, which tells us that the consumer still thinks that gasoline is quite inexpensive.
They think it's inexpensive. Is it that, or that they just are resistant to conserving energy and cutting back on their gas use?
Well, think about it for a minute. You go buy yourself a $25,000 car. You pay a $1,700 insurance premium every year. And when you get the car fixed, sometimes it costs you $400, $500. You're probably paying about $800 to $1,000 a year on gasoline. And now with these higher prices, maybe $1,200. It's still less than your insurance premium.
So relatively, it's less. And some people say it should be more. So let's get to what you think can be done to bring things more into balance.
Well, I think in the short term, if you take a look at what the situation is, you have a world supply of about 84 million barrels a day, and you have a world demand of 83.6. It means you have almost no surplus of oil anywhere in the world. And there's nothing on the horizon that's going to change the supply availability in the short term. Maybe a year and a half out, maybe a year from now, but for the next 4 or 5 months, we're sort of stuck with the supply we've got. That leaves you demand. And if you can reduce demand, even by, let's say, worldwide 3 million barrels, that would have a significant downward pressure on price.
And how would you reduce demand?
Well, I think it's really not how I or how the government will reduce demand. It's where how the public is willing to reduce its use of oil. And if the public continues to increase its consumption of gasoline, as it has throughout the fall and the early winter, the reality is that those prices are not going to drop. In fact, they may even go up even higher than they are now.
Well, some people say the government can reduce demand. One energy economist is calling for a gas tax of $2 or $3 per gallon. It would be offset in his plan by a Social Security payroll tax reduction. And Tom Friedman, who's been on this bandwagon, says the only way Americans are ever going to get cheaper gasoline again is to raise the price with a gas tax at such a high level that people aren't buying as much, you know, they're forced to conserve, and therefore it's not as profitable. So therefore, investors don't invest in it and invest in alternative energies and develop alternative sources. And he says there are a lot of people, as you know, who are saying, make gasoline more expensive.
Well, I guess I would say two things. One is, what do you think the probability that this Congress is going to pass a $2 gasoline tax right now? I think that's probably a null set. I do believe, and I'll give you one idea that I've espoused and I think makes a lot of sense, which is one of the problems with investment is that oil prices and gasoline prices go up and down. And if you're an investor and you have a lot of money to put in it, one of the things you fear is that by the time your project comes online, the oil prices will have fallen significantly and you will lose money. Mm. So there is a hesitancy to make investment. If you had a floor of, let's say, $40, $45 and said, well, if the price goes below it, a federal tax will come into being and will tax the price of oil back to, let's say, 40 or 45, right. You would give a huge incentive to investors to put their money in new alternative energy projects,
right.
Which they don't have right now.
And that's part of what Tom Friedman says. He says, make it clear it's going to stay.
Yes.
These taxes are going to keep it at a high price so that investors aren't looking to invest in the future. They'll turn somewhere else.
That's exactly correct.
So, but going back to your original thought, you're saying that it's largely going to be up to the consumer to conserve.
Government is not likely to take any action to affect demand in terms of higher taxes. And this means mandatory controls, which I think are really unlikely. And you've seen the consumer do this in electricity in the California market when they had the blackouts and brownouts. They increased the price by approximately 15-20%, and they reduced demand by 10%.
People just started conserving and not
yes,
using
exactly.
their electricity. You say apply the same thinking to gas.
Well, I think what you need is some leadership from Washington that says to the consumer, there is no easy out of this. We're not going to give you a $100 rebate or give you a tax holiday on gasoline taxes. We have to deal with this and face the problem head on. It means we've got to reduce our consumption. The president started this with his addiction to oil speech in the State of the Union, but that hasn't continued. And right now, we're looking for these sort of magic answers where the consumer will feel no pain, but there are no magic answers.
Mm. You know, we know in Europe, Europeans pay upwards of $4 a gallon of gas, and their cars get much better gas mileage. Why is that?
Well, in England, consumers are paying approximately $6.60 a gallon right now for gasoline. Of that, approximately $4.20 are taxes. They have come to accept in Europe that taxing gasoline is an appropriate way of raising revenue. Now, in terms of the efficiency of the European automobile fleet, it's only about 5 miles per gallon better than the fleet in this country, which shows you how high gasoline prices have to go to change consumer buying habits.
Is it just a mindset, you know, that they just think, I mean, Americans say they wouldn't accept a $6 a gallon of gas. We may be headed for it, but they would find it outrageous.
They certainly wouldn't accept it in the short term. But prices went up to $6, which I don't see any reason they will unless mm-hmm. the government puts a tax on it, my guess is that after complaining for a year or two, they would adjust to it. But it's harder in this country than it is in England because we're geographically a lot bigger, and people live a lot further from their workplace than they do in England.
That's Henry Lee from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He'll be back in a moment, and we'll also check in on Congress. But first, this international note, the presidents of Argentina and Brazil meet with Bolivia's president today to express concern about his move this week to nationalize Bolivia's natural gas company. There are concerns about how Bolivia will pay for nationalizing the gas industry. So what can the government do? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. The media is questioning President Bush's new nominee for Interior Secretary. One of the topics, drilling in the Anwar Wildlife Reserve. We're going to check in on what else Congress is considering today regarding the price of gas. But we've been talking with Henry Lee, a lecturer in public policy and director of the Environment and Natural Resources Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And, Professor, a lot of people are clamoring for some way to reduce the huge oil company profits. In your opinion, would taxing the oil companies for their huge profits have any effect on the cost of gas?
Yeah, I think it would. I think it would go up. If there is a windfall profits tax, one of the results will be investors will be at the margin reluctant to put money into new supply options. Therefore, there would be less supply and by the laws of supply and demand, higher prices.
What do you see for the oil business 10 years from now?
If you look out into the future, whether it's 10 years or 15 or 20 years, there is plenty of oil in the world, but we're running out of cheap oil. We have a lot of expensive oil.
And what do you mean by expensive? Hard to get? Or?
Well, exactly. A lot of the oil we have now is very cheap to get. It's think of it like putting a straw into a big pool.
Yeah.
But we're running out of pools. Now we're going to have to find chemicals to put down there to try and absorb the oil before we bring it up. We're going to have to look for oil from other sources like gas, coal,
sand,
shale, oil sands. Mm. All of this is more expensive. So I think that one of the things on the horizon that you have to remember is there is an issue we haven't discussed today that is looming like a great big thundercloud out in the future, which is climate change. And it's almost inevitable that the governments of the world are going to get their act together sometime and address this problem. And that means that will mean higher energy prices across the board for anything that is derived from fossil fuels.
Because?
Simply because the only way you're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or carbon emissions is by increasing the price of carbon, and carbon is contained in all fossil fuels. We are on almost an unstoppable upward trend on petroleum prices.
So you're saying if consumers don't change their fuel buying habits because of the cost of gas, they'll be forced to because of the cost of the problems of global warming. But back to gas, do you ever see those prices going down?
I think one of the things I fear is that we will approach the present problem and try to bandage it. And I think we're going to have to get used to the fact that we're entering a world of higher fossil fuel prices and higher oil prices. And we're going to have to adjust to that world.
Get used to it. Henry Lee, lecturer in public policy and director of the Environment and Natural Resources Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Well, for a legislative update, we turn now to Boston Globe reporter Rick Klein, who speaking to us from Washington. And Rick, so we hear the idea of a $100 rebate to consumers is dead in Congress after a lot of ridicule. But what about the gas tax? Some want to lower it to give drivers a break. Some want to raise it to force them to conserve. What's happening?
Well, there's a Democratic plan in the Senate right now to do a temporary moratorium on the federal gas tax. It's about 18 cents a gallon to provide at least some temporary relief to consumers. But I think the concern by a lot of other members of Congress is that there is no guarantee that this savings would get passed on to the consumer. So there is really no surefire way to use the gas tax to bring it down. Now, the proposals to raise the gas tax are more on the academic level. I don't think there's any members of Congress who are attaching their names to a proposal like that.
Well, Professor Lee talked about supply. He says drilling offers no short-term solution. But what about Bill Frist's and others calling for opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling? You know, will Republicans finally win passage of that?
We're going to be hearing a lot about that in the next couple of days and into next week. That's a key part of a Senate plan. There have been a lot of problems passing this in the past. It's been subject to filibuster in the Senate. Last year, it finally passed the Senate, but it was in the House that they had problems. And there's a lot of concern about the environmental impact of that. But who knows? This could be the tipping point. I mean, the supporters of drilling in the Arctic Refuge have only been one or two votes short the last few times. And maybe this is what, you know, in an election year, this is what supporters of drilling need to push them over the edge.
Well, putting that possibility aside, it doesn't seem as if Congress has other alternatives to bringing down gas prices. Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey says this is a nightmare for Republicans. Do you think that's true, or is everyone in Congress going to be tarred with the same brush?
I think historically what we've seen in other big years like 1974, 1980, where gas prices were a big issue, voters have taken it out on the ruling party. Particularly in this case, we're talking about the Republican Party, which has long been the favorite of oil and gas interests. President Bush and Dick Cheney, obviously both former oil men themselves. It's hard for Republicans to really separate themselves fully from these companies. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, incumbents everywhere could end up suffering if people decide to throw all the bums out.
Right. Well, while we have you, give us a quick update on an alternative fuel idea that's certainly been politicized. It's been controversial here in Massachusetts. Suddenly, it's in Congress. It's a private firm here in Massachusetts making a bid to build a 130-turbine, 24-square-mile wind farm in the public waters off of Cape Cod. Backers say it's clean, it's alternative. Detractors say it pollutes the pristine view, and they have other concerns as well. But one of those detractors has been accused of playing the not-in-my-backyard card.
Yeah, and I think you're referring to Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts there. Mm-hmm. He helped insert a provision into a Coast Guard bill, and have anything to do with energy, into a Coast Guard bill that would block construction of the wind farm by giving Governor Romney a veto over it. And Governor Romney is also an opponent of the wind farm.
And Governor Romney is a Republican.
That's right. This crosses party lines. And their point, and there's a lot to this argument, Senator Kennedy and Governor Romney will say, is the state needs to have some kind of say in what's going on here, that we have here private developers that are trying to take advantage of a loophole in federal and state laws to put a for-profit energy farm up in publicly owned property, and they need to have a role in this. But there are a lot of people, a lot of environmentalists, a lot of them were used to having Senator Kennedy on their side, by the way, who see this as the vanguard of a new and very promising area of energy. And they really think that if it doesn't happen here off the coast of Nantucket, that it's going to be a long time before it can happen anywhere.
Well, and you know, the question many here in Massachusetts have is, you know, one of the concerns is that it's right in an area that's a high tourist and high income for the people who live in that area, for the state. Why can't it be moved further out to sea?
Good question. The problem is the further you get out, though, the more expensive it gets to lay the transmission lines. You actually have to get the electricity from the turbines themselves onto shore.
Well, we know other states are watching this as they consider alternative energy. What's next for the Massachusetts wind farm proposal?
Well, for now it's on hold, but there's a major effort in Congress to revive it. I think the combination of the high gas prices and some anger about how the hold was actually inserted into the legislation has made a lot of people angry over it, and it could very easily get restarted in the next couple of weeks.
Rick Klein covers Congress for the Boston Globe. Rick, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston. Held a hearing on how next month's World Cup soccer games in Germany could become a destination for illegally trafficked women. Selling sex is legal in Germany, and with the World Cup attracting 1 million visiting soccer fans, some cities are readying for as many as 40,000 prostitutes from abroad, with things like drive-through brothels. But human rights officials are worried that many women will be trafficked in against their will. Andreas Georgis writes for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us on the line from Berlin. And Andreas, tell us first about reports of these drive-through brothels catering to soccer fans in cities like Cologne.
The drive-through brothels they're talking about are trailers that were actually set up in Cologne probably about 4 or 5 years ago as part of a social project where prostitutes can do their business with johns, but where the police have a bit more oversight. It also helps protect the prostitutes themselves. It ensures that they're not taken advantage of by their johns and not exploited.
Journalists have flocked to see this drive-through brothel where apparently you can drive into a barn-like structure, have your business exchange, and then drive out the other side.
That's right. The city of Cologne was so incensed by the media coverage, the women started to complain because they felt like zoo animals being photographed and filmed by camera teams from Sweden all the way down to Italy, all the way over to America. And they've decided to, for the time being at least, to ban all journalists from that area.
And the city can do that because they own the land that the brothels are on.
Absolutely.
Well, in fact, prostitution has been legal in Germany for a while, but we understand there was a new law passed in 2002.
Yes, there was. The new law gave prostitutes more social and more legal rights, gave them the ability to pay into unemployment insurance and the ability to pay into health insurance.
But the concern is that so many women may be coming in from outside of the country, and many of them unwillingly victims of trafficking. As we said, Congress is holding a hearing today about this possibility. And a UN report has found that Germany is a top destination for trafficked women from Eastern Europe. Tell us more about that story.
It's certainly a major concern here. There are about 140,000 women within the European Union's borders at the moment who are working as prostitutes and have been forced into that work. During the World Cup, police are planning more regular raids on brothels in order to kind of tackle this problem in an active law enforcement way.
Well, we've heard stories here in the U.S. of women, for instance, from Russia, paying smugglers to bring them across the border from Mexico, thinking that they're going to get jobs. And when they get in the U.S., they're told that, in fact, they've been trafficked in the sex trade and, you know, they'll be killed if they don't do it.
You hit it right on the head. I don't think the strategies differ much from Eastern Europe to Mexico. Here you have women who have been promised jobs, day labor jobs. We're talking about housework. We're talking about nannies taking care of children. They allow themselves to be brought across the borders by somewhat dubious personalities. And then once they arrive here, they're told something like, you know, well, you have to pay is 5,000 euros, and you have to work off those 5,000 euros in order to return home.
Andreas, the World Cup is a big deal, and I'm sure German officials were hoping that that would be the spotlight. Instead, it seems to have shifted somewhat to this idea of, you know, for instance, cities like Cologne having drive-through brothels on city land. Are they at all worried about, you know, this hurting, for instance, their legitimate tourist trade, changing the image of the country from one with beautiful castles to one as a sex destination?
I don't think so. I think this has been something that has been legal in Germany for a very long time. And sure, they're very intent on taking the forced prostitution problem seriously. But this is something that will be a big issue in maybe the month or two before the World Cup, but afterwards will die down again.
Andreas Georgis of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us from Berlin about the expected influx of prostitutes into Germany for the upcoming Soccer World Cup. Andreas, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, the Artemis brothel in Berlin is one of the largest in Europe. It has a swimming pool, saunas, movie theaters, and, of course, hotel rooms. Vanessa Rahn is public relations director for this four-story facility. And, Vanessa, first of all, what sort of plans is your facility making to prepare for all the soccer fans that are expected to come? Are you doing something different?
Okay. Actually, we prepare for the World Cup. Each 21st guest in the house will have a free entry, and each 50 guests will have a bottle of champagne for free.
So you're having a World Cup special. Well, we should explain that at your facility, all of the prostitutes are self-employed. They pay a fee to enter, and then they negotiate fees with clients who have also paid a cover charge. But as you said, you're going to have a special where some of them might get in free. What are you doing to ensure that the women who are coming in, the self-employed prostitutes who are going to pay the fee to enter, that they haven't been trafficked into the country?
First of all, we check all the documents, and if the documents are not completed, they can't even start working.
What kind of documents?
That means like the passport, if they're not from the European Union. They need to have special papers, of course, that they are legal in Germany and that they are allowed to work in here self-employed at our house.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried about women being trafficked into Germany during the World Cup?
Yes, I'm worried about. The numbers we hear are almost 40,000 prostitutes that they say that will be forced to work like prostitutes in Germany. But actually, we only have a look at our house. We can only work with our house. And all the girls who'd like to work in here, they hear from other girls that the work in here is really nice and they have a lot of freedom.
How much do the women pay to enter the house? And then what are some of the fees that they might be paid once they're inside?
When they want to work in here, they need to pay an entry of 50 euros.
That's about about 60 American dollars.
Yeah. And when they pay their entry each day, they have the food in the restaurant for free in the morning and in the evening. They also have the free use of the wellness area downstairs included in their entry, and they have the non-alcoholic drinks and also the hotel room upstairs for them.
And do they have to give any of the money that they make back to the Artemis?
No, they don't.
Some would say that this is a far better setup for women because they are, you know, at least if it goes according to your plan, they don't have to give money to, let's say, a pimp. But what do you say to women who say that it's demeaning for a woman to sell her body?
The women who work in here, they feel really secure because we have security all over the day, 24 hours a day. And so it's really comfortable to work as a prostitute in this house.
Well, Vanessa, you know, we're making it sound as if it's the World Cup of sex that's taking place. Are people talking as much about this as it seems, or are they talking more about the soccer?
Oh, actually, I think they talk a lot about the soccer. I think, like, the prostitution is something that will happen during the World Cup. But in my opinion, I don't even know if this will happen the way everybody expects it. If there are almost 40,000 coming up, I don't think so.
Vanessa Rahn, public relations director for the Artemis brothel in Berlin. They are expecting an increase in business next month when millions of World Cup soccer fans come to Germany. Vanessa, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you also.
And you're listening to Here and Now. And now a little baseball. Slugger Barry Bonds of the San Francisco Giants is not expected to be in the lineup in today's game in Milwaukee. He was hit by a foul ball during practice last night, so fans have to wait. Bonds is just 3 home runs shy of passing Babe Ruth to take second place on baseball's all-time home run list. Of course, Hank Aaron is at the top with 755 home runs. Babe Ruth finished with 714, and he hit his last 3 in a single game in May of 1935, 71 years ago this month. Lee Monfils is the author of a new biography of Babe Ruth. It's called The Big Bam, The Life and Times of Babe Ruth. And Lee, at the end of Ruth's career, you write, he was a doddering old man. You know, it's kind of a sad story. Most of the Pittsburgh Pirates he was up against thought he was done. But as you write in your new book, on that day in Pittsburgh, the sun shone on his large head for one last day in the major leagues. What happened?
He hit 3 home runs, plus a single in the middle.
Yeah.
He hit one after another, and the fourth one was the longest ball ever hit in Forbes Field in Pittsburgh. It went 500 feet. It was like a high fly ball that just never stopped and just went around. And he was moving really badly at the time, and it was just an agony to watch him go around the bases. And that was his final hit of his career.
And, of course, as you write, no one knew it then.
After the game, a bunch of people tried to get him to retire, but he said he still had to finish the road trip. The road trip had a couple more stops, and he said that they were going to have celebrations for him in each of the stops, and he felt it was his obligation to keep going.
And we should mention to people, this is a Babe Ruth that had already gone from the Boston Red Sox to the New York Yankees, but back to the Boston Braves, so he's playing for the Braves at that point. His retirement was bitter. He doesn't leave the game. He plays exhibition games, and one in the Bronx on September 29th, 1935. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a place called the Dyckman Oval. 10,000 people came out, and I think the prices were $1.10 for grandstand and 55 cents for bleachers. And he played against the New York Cubans, a Negro League team, and the pitcher was a guy named Louis Tiant, whose son later came to the major leagues and became a great pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And the Babe went 1-for-4, and it was a doubleheader. And he felt he hadn't given the people a big enough show. So between the games, he had a guy come out, and he just started pounding baseballs all over the place. And that was his curtain call, really.
As you describe it, it was, you know, might have seemed a pathetic sight to see this, you know, former great out, you know, just trying to get a hit in front of a small crowd who paid 55 cents. But as you write, it was actually perfect.
I think half the towns in America, he hit the longest home run ever seen. And if you were a pretty good baseball player back in the 20s, you probably played against Babe Ruth somewhere because he played against everybody.
Because he wanted a hit. He wanted to see that ball sail. Well, after immersing...
He wanted the money, too.
He wanted the money, too. Yeah. Well, after you're immersing yourself in the world of Babe Ruth, what are your thoughts about Barry Bonds passing him on the all-time home run list?
I don't know. It's a weird thing. I'd be fortuitous timing, this book coming out. I'm like the voice of Babe Ruth. I'm staying up late, drinking a lot, and eating a lot, and chasing strange women. It's hitting the home runs is the hard part. I don't know. I think Babe was Lindbergh going across the Atlantic with a couple of ham sandwiches in the cockpit. And these guys that have come along now, Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire and them, it's all such a big business. To me, they seem like Steve Fawcett and Richard Branson, you know, off in their balloon. And it's a nice record, but it's not the same.
These are the wealthy owners of, like, Virgin Airlines, for instance. They don't compare, as you say.
These guys have whatever supplements they have. They have video vaults of all the pitchers they're facing. They have computer things telling them tendencies. They have personal trainers and managers and statsmen and all the rest. And, you know, the Babe just kind of had himself.
And just to go back to that story of his last official game and the 3 home runs, what happened back then is that a bunch of players just gathered around in the locker room beforehand and tried to figure out how to pitch to somebody. And boy, were they wrong. But there was one guy who had been a student of Babe's, as you say, had played with him, Waite Hoyt, and he said, you have your choice, one base on 4 balls, you know, walk 'em, or 4 bases on 1 ball.
That was the perfect strategy for Babe Ruth. And that's what they use with Barry Bonds today.
Well, when they get the chance. As we said, Barry Bonds not expected to be in the lineup this afternoon when the Giants play the Brewers in Milwaukee. Lee Monfils, author of The Big Bam, The Life and Times of Babe Ruth, will be watching with the rest of us to see when Bonds gets to bat. Will he walk or will he run? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. That's On the Floor, a piece performed at a recent concert at Princeton University, and a work created by an orchestra of networked laptop computers. The Princeton Laptop Orchestra is the brainchild of two Princeton professors, and we welcome them now from WPRB in Princeton, New Jersey. Perry Cook teaches computer science and music. Welcome, Professor Cook.
Hello.
And we're also speaking with music professor Dan Truman, who joins us as well. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And Perry, if I may call you Perry, Professor Cook, you describe this Princeton Laptop Orchestra, or PLORC, as an ensemble of computer-based musical meta-instruments. That means nothing
yes.
to us. What is that?
Well, it's basically the idea that because it's a computer which is programmable, you can program it to be a variety of different types of sound producing, music making, human interfacing objects.
How, for instance, is this different from, let's say, a Kurzweil, you know, a computerized keyboard that plays music and you may not even know it's from a computer? It can sound almost organic. How is this different from that?
The Kurzweil is pre-designed to do very specific things and to do them very well. And so if you want to do those things, the Kurzweil is great. But if you have some other idea for how you'd like a person to use the computer in some kind of musical way, you're out of luck. With the laptop orchestra, you can write your own programs to make the laptop respond to what you do and generate sound in a unique way, one that's unique for your piece. And so, in fact, one of the great challenges for the composers in this is to, from scratch, figure out what each of these instruments is going to do for them.
Professor Cook, tell us, what are we seeing when we see the orchestra? What does it look like?
We sit on the floor on pillows, colorful pillows. Each player has a laptop and a little rack, which has the interface to the multi-channel sound card and multi-channels of amplifiers, and a hemispherical speaker, which sits on the floor. So each person's laptop is making sound from the speaker that's sitting right next to them.
And Professor Truman, who conducts this whole thing?
In some pieces, one of us might stand up there and wave our arms the way an old-fashioned conductor would. In other pieces, we might have somebody with a laptop that is connected to all the other laptops with a wireless network sending, say, text messages to various sections within the ensemble, instructing them what to do.
Where would that come from? Would somebody be like, you know, the Great Oz sitting off somewhere, you know, text messaging somebody, you know, vibrato here or...
Right. In fact, in one of the pieces by Brad Garton that we did, he sat in the audience with his laptop, and nobody really knew what he was doing there with his laptop, but in fact, he was conducting his piece. This piece is called Idle Swamp by Brad Garton, and he lives in a swamp in New Jersey, and so it's inspired in some ways by where he lives. And it starts with what sounds like frogs and crickets from the various laptops. In fact, the instruction to the player is to pretend that you're a frog and make a frog sound when you think it's appropriate time to do so.
With your laptop,
that's right. Over the course of the first couple minutes of the piece, those frog sounds are gradually transformed upward in pitch until you start to recognize that's actually the sound of somebody's voice. And it turns into this kind of chattering swamp. You can't understand what they're saying, but it's this rhythmic chatter that sounds like speech.
Some of the questions that Plourk raises and wants to explore is, you know, how can we physically control these sounds? And that in some of the pieces, instruments interact with the musician's body movements. How does that work?
We have a variety of sensors, tilt sensors that players wear on their hands that can tell motion and orientation of the hands. We have pressure sensors. One of the pieces was actually conducted by an Asian dancer who studied in a tradition where hand motion and subtle hand motion is very important, and so it worked really well for that. And she taught the players how to control those instruments essentially with their hands as dancers.
That piece was called In Still by Curtis Bond and Tomie Han.
Artists like Laurie Anderson have, you know, long worked with computers. The big difference with this group is that it's an orchestra. And I'm wondering, do the musicians, maybe even such as yourself in Plourk, do you worry about, you know, replacing yourselves, replacing real flesh and blood musicians? Or is this a completely separate art?
One of the premises of Plourk is we're trying to find out what new kind of music is possible with this ensemble that simply isn't possible otherwise. And we're not really interested in, say, playing Beethoven with the laptop orchestra. The closest we've gotten is we've played the ABC song in three-part harmony. And I think that's probably as far as we'll go.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
One of the things that's pretty exciting is to actually mix old instruments with new instruments. We did this a couple times with in this program with where we had Pauline Oliveros playing accordion with the orchestra and Zakir Hussain playing, you know, tablas, these old drums with the orchestra. And kind of finding a new context for these old instruments is a really interesting thing to try.
Well, Dan Truman and Perry Cook, co-founders of the Princeton Laptop Orchestra, or PLORC. For more information about their performances and to hear more of the music, go to our website, here-now.org. And gentlemen, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, if you're in the area, they'll be performing this weekend at Dartmouth College up in New Hampshire. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.